Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hello and welcome to Mid-Atlantic, the show where we look at the news and the views from one side of the Atlantic from the perspective of the other. I'm Royfield Brown, who's in a hot, sticky, sweaty Burlington in southern Ontario. Today we are joined by Matthew Green, MP from the riding of Hamilton Centre of the New Democratic Party, Matt Genero, who's also a Member of Parliament from the riding of Edmonton Riverbend. He represents the Conservative Party. We have Nadine Nakagawa. She's a city councillor in the city of New Westminster in British Columbia. We have Amina Yazin, who is a city and regional planner who sits on the Vancouver City Planning Commission. We have Ariel Carabaga, who is a city councillor from London, Ontario. Now, she won the Liberal Party's nomination to run in the riding of London West. We also have Alex Bishop, who helps companies access grants, investments, and gives them kind of access to the government. He's a political pundit of some renown. And finally, we have Alan Mankiewicz, who's a disability rights activist from Manitoba. On the day when numerous Americans and Afghans have been reportedly killed by two explosions outside Kabul airport, we take a pause to regret their loss. And we also ask, what are the major themes of Canada's snap election?
This is a really important moment in Canada's history.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Sunday called an early election for September 20th, saying he needed a new mandate to ensure voters approved of his Liberal government's plan to recover from the health crisis.
As Canadians know, this is a moment where we're going to be taking decisions that will last not just for the coming months, but for the coming decades. And Canadians deserve their say. That's exactly what we're going to give them.
Trudeau is betting that high vaccination rates and an economic rebound will help him prolong and strengthen his position as prime minister. Newly released data shows 71% of the country's eligible population is fully vaccinated. Trudeau spoke after visiting Governor General Mary Simon, the representative of head of state Queen Elizabeth, to formally request the dissolution of Parliament. Polls suggest the Liberals will win their third consecutive election, but may not regain a majority in the House of Commons. Trudeau currently has only a minority of seats, leaving him reliant on other parties to govern. The Conservatives and New Democrats have in recent days condemned the idea of an early election, saying there was no need for it and describing Trudeau's call as a power grab.
First off, this is for the Canadians on stage. And Matt, because I know your time is short, we're going to start with you. You're a sitting MP. What do you think are the overriding issues of this election are going to be? This is your hot take, so please be brief.
Thanks, Rafield and Alex for making this happen. Hot takes, I think he kind of hit it in a bit of the introduction there with this being a snap election. I think ultimately on the date that it was called, we started hearing some of the news out of Afghanistan as well. So I can certainly tell you at the doors, we've been hearing a lot about an unnecessary election in a very crucial international time. I don't think that's necessarily a partisan comment that people are saying. It's certainly our thoughts and minds and hearts are elsewhere right now. But we're going full steam ahead, and I guess everybody across the country is running, and we'll ultimately see on September 20th which party takes office.
Alex, what's your hot take? What do you think the overriding issues are going to be and should be in this election?
Yeah, I think the fact is that Trudeau would say that the polling is in his favor, and I think it would be fair to say that he's making the election based on that gamble. I think there's issues of security that are coming up, especially because of what's happening in Afghanistan. I think there's issues around that have been pointed out by the media, talking about the Conservative Party being divided. There's issues around the NDP party being divided. There's issues around the Liberal Party being divided. So I think what I'm hearing in terms of what are the issues is what issues, and maybe Matt, you can answer this. What are the issues that you think can unite us? What are the issues that you think are universal that you're hearing at the doors? So the things I'm hearing are ones around mental health, around housing, and around economics.
Before Matt answers that, 1 minute, Matt, let's just go through all the Canadians on stage. Let's do the hot takes, and then we'll enter into the discussion. Alan, what should be, what are going to be the key issues in this campaign?
From my perspective, I think we saw during the pandemic that disabled folks were essentially ignored. They were sitting ducks in for-profit care homes. They disproportionately died compared to the rest of the population. So I think we need some atonement for that and some policy change. And it'll be interesting to see what happens if the Liberals get reelected, what they do with the Canada Disability Benefit they've proposed, and if it was just a cynical ploy to get votes or if they'll actually follow through and do something.
I do want to ask you about that bill, which was introduced in the last parliament. But let's move on for now. Nadine, what are going to be the key election points between now and September the 20th?
A livable planet is number one. The climate crisis and the corresponding equity issues. The housing crisis is still raging in BC, as well as a poison drug supply crisis. So, but overall, healthcare is always a big election issue. And we've seen the need for a national pharmacare strategy. We've seen the need for a national mental health strategy, especially under COVID. And also, you know, the state sanctioned and supported killing of Indigenous children in residential schools. The Kamloops First Nation is here in BC. We have the Squamish First Nation doing the penetrating radar to find the discovery of graves there. I think we have to continue to talk about reconciliation and Indigenous sovereignty as well.
And lastly, Amina, what is your hot take on the key election issue that Canada is facing?
Sure. So I think a lot of really key issues have been brought up. First, I definitely don't think that the climate of apathy and fear, which seem to be the two principal characteristics, you know, that are propelling a mentally exhausted population to the polls, indicates the best possible time for us to be, you know, having a snap election, to be perfectly honest. But as Nadine already articulated, we've seen where the federal government has deployed childcare as a major issue, working quite closely with provinces in order to see that as a primary election issue. Indigenous rights and reconciliation and redress is a major issue, especially considering the fact that I am in British Columbia as well, on the land of the Coast Salish people, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, and Kakat. And as Nadine mentioned, the unmarked graves that have been discovered here of children is definitely going to continue to be an issue. Disability justice and affordable housing, as well as the opioid crisis and wireless broadband across rural communities. So quite a few issues there.
Thank you for that, Amina. So we've had like a real good sweep of some of the key election issues that Canada is grappling with as it decides who its next prime minister is going to be. I'm going to come to you, Matt. The polls have somewhat tightened. We all know that Trudeau called this election because he was doing relatively well in the polls and he has a minority government. Why do you think that your Conservative Party under its new leader, Erin O'Toole, has actually been able to tighten those polls? What has been the key kind of Conservative message which seems to be resonating with the Canadian people?
Yeah, Murphy, I'll also try to answer Alex's question in some of this as well. I think some of the people on stage have hit on what are some good points in terms of uniting us. The housing crisis, climate issue being key. I think probably the biggest one though, and can tie back around to your question, Rofield, is the health crisis that we're facing right now through COVID. I think there's a fair bit of division out there on how best to handle whether it be the health and Canadians or the economic future of Canada. And I think that's ultimately where I believe we've had some success over the last, sorry, I'm in my campaign office, so it's a bit loud. I've had some success at the doors over the last few weeks, and probably we've seen in the polls come up a bit more, and that's ultimately where I feel here, at least in Alberta, we're really trying to make a headway. Which we have the seats in Alberta, which are good, but it's the seats across the country, and can throw in stuff like the Nova Scotia election. I think gives a lot of people some hope across the country as well, at least on our Conservative side, that we saw the results of that particular election, and it's feeling reasonably good. So,
but Matt, I'm just going to jump in. Is it really Conservative messaging which has been able to tighten these polls, or is it just a bit of Trudeau fatigue and maybe Trudeau hubris, of which you guys have actually just picked up on?
I was trying to be polite to him, Raphael, but I think you're right. I think there's certainly some of that. It's been 6 years, and these are promises that have been made and promises that haven't necessarily been kept. In certain issues, you look at the housing crisis, I think being a key one at that, where there's a number of people who had high hopes in 2015 that there was going to be positive steps made on that. And we certainly, if you go to major cities like Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, there's still a massive housing crisis facing those cities. So yeah, that's probably a element of it. I would like to think that there's also people who are looking for that perhaps alternative and new message, perhaps of hope or optimism. And that's at least what we're trying to do in our campaign locally. And I think our leader's done some of that nationally, which hopefully is also attracting people to it, as opposed to just voting against something, voting for something at the end of the day.
OK, so many of you have basically said that housing is a key issue. You yourself, Matt, also said that as well. So, Amina, could you give us some sense of what the housing crisis actually is in Canada, as the reasons why so many Canadians think that it's one of the top and key election issues?
Sure. So in many of the same ways that we see the housing crisis unfold, on the other side of the border, in America, we share a lot of the same issues. But across Canada, we are specifically facing a housing crisis due to decades of lack of federal government investment in housing, especially rental housing, as well as municipal exclusionary urban planning and land use regulations, empty homes and speculation as well, as the financialization of rental housing, which has essentially transformed Canada's multifamily purpose-built rental sector. So we see, again, and this is a global phenomenon, but definitely impacting Canada as well, which is the rise of financial landlords and real estate investment trusts, or REITs, across Canadian cities, essentially since 1996, have changed the dynamics of rental apartments being homes in Canada and turning them into commodities and into becoming for-profit investments, essentially driving rents even higher and resulting in mass displacements and rent evictions. So by systemically driving up rents, prices, the business strategies of these financial landlords essentially affect affordability through unit turns, is what it's called. So in Canada, for every one affordable unit created by government funding, approximately 15 can and do become unaffordable due to the financialization of rental housing. And so it's definitely a huge issue. It's a huge crushing supply side and land use issue due to red tapes. It's also a speculative market issue. And so it's definitely going to be something that each party has to contend with. And so any question that I would have is how the parties are really looking at ensuring that we do preserve affordability in perpetuity when it comes to our rental housing stock, but also how do we ensure that we remove some of that red tape in our housing system as it currently exists in relation to supply side considerations.
Alex, you kind of help organizations actually get access to government funds, government loans, government grants, etc. Give us a sense of some of this red tape which can actually help alleviate the housing crisis.
So one of the things I'll give Trudeau some credit for, he created a program through the CMHC, which is a Crown corporation, the Canadian Mortgage Housing Corporation, to allow for a 75% of the cost of affordable housing, and even 85% in some cases, to be funded through a construction loan. So the bridge is still that, last 15-20% or so. So that was one thing that he did to help things. The problem is, I think a lot of it has to do with the culture in government. It really needs to change. We need to find a way to give our senior bureaucrats the opportunity to take risks, to make change, to not have to feel like they're going to get pounded on when they do something new and novel and innovative. There also needs to be more funding envelopes if we're going to have it go through government. If we're not going to have it go through government, or we're going to offer other funding envelopes, then we really need to incentivize our banking system to open up their pocketbooks. And we need to have systems and processes to make that happen.
I want to move on to disability. The Ministry of Employment, Workforce and Development and Disability Inclusion, Carla Qualtrough, introduced legislation in the last parliament for a new disability benefit. Sarah Jarma, you've just joined our stage. Why is that legislation important? Is it enough? And why do you think this is so resonated with the Canadian people that they say that disability rights and access is one of the key election issues?
Hi, everyone. Sorry I'm late. I'm from Hamilton. Hamilton has the largest number of disabled people in the province of Ontario. And so that's kind of where I orient myself. And I'm with the Disability Justice Network of Ontario. I'm not doing the greatest, so I'm just going to preface this with that. But the issue with Minister Qualtrough's disability benefit is that the government has been well aware that in every single province across this country, social assistance has been below the poverty line. So that means if you're not able to work because of your disability and you're forced into taking social assistance, you're below the poverty line. And there are also other issues as well that force people into poverty, such as wheelchair. Like, people say we have universal health care, but assistive devices are not fully covered by the government, meaning depending on how much you make, you have to pay thousands of dollars for your equipment, whether it's an oxygen tank, hearing aids, or assistive devices. Home care is not properly accessible or properly funded. And neither is palliative care. And so to promise a feasibility study around this disability benefit, to do strange consultations with a handful of community members, myself included, to offer lift service without any actual promise in terms of amounts, right before an election, goes to show that they understand how they have ignored disabled people and are now scrambling to get disabled people to vote in this election. I think we saw evidence of this with the CERB, right? The emergency response benefit that people received while everyone else was able to get $2,000 a month because of the pandemic. Disabled people got a one-time payment of $600 while living in poverty, while not able to work. And so this promise of a benefit, when we've seen over and over again an inability to actually try to lift people who are disabled out of poverty over time, yeah, it's not rooted in reality, and it's something that they're doing to try to just get votes, in my opinion.
I'd like to ask everybody for a hot take, and I'm just going to go through one leader, and you let me know how you think he or she is doing. So let's start with you, Sarah. Justin Trudeau, he went into the polls thinking that this was somewhat of a slam dunk. Vaccination rates are very high in Canada, some of the highest in the world after a terrible start. The economy seems to have rebounded before the Delta crisis anyway. So he thought he would get his majority. How do you think he's done so far on the campaign trail?
I don't think Justin Trudeau is serious. If he actually cared about people in this country, he wouldn't be taking Indigenous kids to court. He would have done all he could to take care of the long-term care home crisis that we're experiencing that led to the death of thousands upon thousands of people across the country. He left disabled people out to dry when it came to the vaccine rollout, but then also around CERB and emergency supports. He overall talks a lot and sounds progressive, but hasn't actually implemented policy that can better people's lives in the ways that he claims to. So he does a lot of like showing up, but he doesn't reflect that in his policy.
Alex, give us an assessment on the Conservative leader, Erin O'Toole. Whatever he's doing, even if he's not really talking, he seems to be narrowing those polls.
Yeah, I think he's getting some help from some of Trudeau's own cabinet ministers who are seemingly making a lot of very predictable errors, unforced errors. There was a minister yesterday, Miriam Monsef, as a background, claimed to be the first Iranian-Canadian member of parliament, and she found out, maybe due to no fault of her own, that she's from Afghanistan. She referred to the Taliban as our brothers, the Taliban, and that's going to, you know, hit Trudeau for a few days. I think the reason why Erin's doing well is less because of Erin and more due to the gaffes that we're going to continue seeing from the Liberal Party.
Alan?
I think it's also an incredible conservative talking point to mention that, you know, Monsef referred to the Taliban as brothers, considering the cultural elements in relation to that speech. And I definitely do see it as something that the conservatives have been running away with, you know, as a talking point. I don't really specifically see it as something that speaks to Erin O'Toole necessarily doing well in relation to that.
Nadine. So Jagmeet Singh is leader of the NDP. The NDP potentially can take a lot of seats in this election. How do you think he's doing? What do you think are some of the strengths of the key messaging of the New Democratic Party?
It's an interesting question about Jagmeet, because we have a country that has shown itself to be, it's exposed its racist undercore. And he faced this in 2019 as well. And now we have a Black woman as a leader of a federal party as well. And so I wonder if the racist attacks will actually be dispersed amongst the two of them. Clearly, Jagmeet has some real strengths, but I think what we're not talking about in this discussion at all is that election campaigns are not popularity contests. They're voter turnout contests. And I think what's very, very likely is we're going to see a suppressed voter turnout in this campaign because people are exhausted. People are cynical. This is an unnecessary election. When we think about Indigenous communities who have seen, you know, in the 2015 election, some uptick in voter turnout and would be more likely to vote for progressive governments that care about issues around reconciliation, they are destroyed. Like, they are very, very, you know, when I talk to people I know who are First Nations or Indigenous, they are very depressed. They're having a hard time struggling right now with the weight of the world and are very unlikely to come out and vote for a colonial government. So I think for a lot of reasons, we're seeing that there's no campaigning on universities this time. When we talk about having less voting stations, which the Conservative MP said impacts everyone equally. It absolutely does not impact everyone equally. That systematically tends to disenfranchise people who are renters, people who are low income, again, Indigenous communities, people who have more difficulty getting to the polling stations. So for a lot of reasons, I think we're going to see lower voter turnout as a systemic issue. And what that will likely do is that will likely hurt Jagmeet Singh so it doesn't actually matter to me how well he's doing on the campaign trail. He is set up for a very difficult battle here.
Okay, so this is an open question, so anybody feel free to unmute. So if there is a low voter turnout, significantly lower than the last election in 2019, who does that benefit? Who does that disadvantage? Obviously, Nadine has said the NDP, but anybody feel free to unmute and just jump in.
Well, it would definitely, I believe, benefit the Conservative Party and not benefit the NDP. I mean, what we're seeing, and I understand that the parties and leaders don't have much of a say in this, but, you know, we're even seeing in relation to voting opportunities on university campuses where, as I understand it, polls, Election Canada came out and said that potentially they wouldn't be able to have the ability to have election opportunities on campuses. We know that students are just returning, and because of the pandemic, there is going to be an impact, I believe, in relation to the youth vote, as well as numerous other populations, for sure.
We haven't talked about the Bloc Québécois, and let's do that now, but let's have a little bit of a history lesson. The Bloc is the French-speaking party which advocates for, dependent on where we are chronologically, separation, independence, or through to at least advocating for kind of strong language rights and the separateness and the uniqueness of Quebec to be recognized within the country of Canada. They have 32 seats in the present parliament. How do they sit above alongside the other national parties? And if anybody could explain to us specifically how they could actually be the kingmaker or not of in this election. So give us a sense, for those of us who aren't Canadian, the political strength of the Bloc Québécois.
Yeah, I won't speak to the political strength of the Bloc Québécois. It's not a party that I specifically lean into.
In a national perspective, because this is part of the political kind of calculus, isn't it? Can the Liberals pick up more seats within Quebec? And we talked about voter enthusiasm before. If there's a lower national turnout, will that be also recognized within Quebec? Or is Quebec distinct enough that French-speaking voters in Quebec will still come out and vote for the Bloc, regardless of any kind of national turnout? It just gives it a sense, because we haven't really spoken about them. We talked about English-speaking bits of Canada, but not actually the French-speaking bit. And anybody feel free just to chime in, and then we can move on.
So, I mean, clearly all of the parties are looking to win, seats in Quebec, undoubtedly. The Liberals for sure have been courting Quebec in a way that has been a convenient marriage, between Trudeau's government and Quebec. And we've seen this in the way in which the Liberals have, essentially sidestepped debates and sort of, looked the other way in regards to Bill 21, which is essentially an economic and mobility restriction bill that harms and specifically targets racialized women and people in Quebec, essentially prohibiting public sector workers from wearing hijabs and turbans on the job. The audience would be familiar with this because we see the same sort of policy making in relation to France. And we see this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
In Quebec as well, under their so-called secularism that they tout, but don't necessarily follow. So it's definitely a Canadian-wide issue, Bill 21, because once you create bills and acts like this in a province, essentially forcing the displacement of a very specific segment of the population, what you intend in turn end up having is essentially internally displaced Canadians who are forced to leave their home province to seek out work, and their charter rights of freedom to religion in other provinces. So this is a Canada-wide problem. Unfortunately, it's not being discussed amongst the parties because, each party is essentially vying for seats in Quebec. The party that would have the most to say on it would and ought to be the NDP party under Jagmeet Singh, as he is an individual who does, wear his religious turban. And I do believe he's made comments in relation to this, but the Trudeau government, has not. We also see the expansion of Bill C-7, which is the medically assisted, death bill, which essentially expanded and removed any sort of safety protocols around that. We saw sort of a coalition of these different parties coming together around that in a way essentially to court, and politicize the lives of incredibly marginalized people in Quebec. So that's how Quebec tends to play into the politics of, or at least I see Quebec playing into the politics of this race.
Thank you. Alex?
So I think what we're going to see is what happens with the Quebec premier. What does Legault do? If Legault who has been playing very chummy with Trudeau during the pandemic, if he continues that, then it's going to give a lot fewer opportunities for the Bloc to speak up and to get noticed. And as a result, I think it's really going to benefit the Liberals. If, on the other hand, the François Legault ends up saying, hey, what about Quebec rights, and starts making issues that Trudeau is going to have to address, then those could be some wedge issues that could allow the Bloc to keep many of its 30-some seats. I think we're going to see a softening as a result of that, because I think it's got to be some very tricky calculus for the Quebec premier to criticize the prime minister, given their relationship over the past year and a half.
One of the key issues in this election is affordability.
Monique Gordon was laid off from her job as a security guard during the pandemic, a job she'd had for 17 years. Two key issues for her in this election: housing, specifically for renters like her, and affordable, accessible childcare.
For me, daycare will be a number one thing. Because if you don't have some place to send a kid so that you can go to work, you can't go to work. And then there's nobody to give you money to pay your rent.
She's undecided, but leaning towards one party.
I would say Jagmeet. He challenges Justin Trudeau.
According to the latest Ipsos polling, the Conservatives have emerged as the number one choice among respondents when it comes to the economy, ahead of the Liberals. The NDP take the top spot on matters of affordability and the cost of living, with the Liberals in the number two spot. Between unprecedented government spending, a jaw-dropping federal deficit estimated at more than $354 billion this fiscal year, and inflation at levels we haven't seen in more than a decade, political observers say that on money matters, liberals are in the hot seat.
They've got a record. They've got 6 years that they have to account for. So it makes them particularly vulnerable.
Millennials and Gen Z now make up the biggest cohort of eligible voters. The pandemic has disproportionately hammered young workers.
Matt, I'm going to come to you. The New Democratic Party are pushing for a new wealth tax. I'm guessing that you conservatives think that's somewhat of an anathema and more likely to be there to cut tax. Canada has a large welfare state. Give us your position on redistribution of wealth, cutting taxes, or even raising them.
Thanks, Ophelia. Your assessment would be rather accurate and historically correct also from my perspective. We had a lot of questions. I'll even toss in something that's been debated a lot as well. The UBI, which is in both of the platforms. I'm not sure if it's in the Liberal. I know it's certainly in the NDP platform. You know, when it comes to where we're going to be at post COVID, like we're pushing a $1 trillion in debt that we're facing as a country. There, certainly that's on the minds of many Canadians and many families who are going to bear the brunt of this debt for a very long time going forward. So things like, you know, UBI, I've come out and I've said to my community, I'm not necessarily opposed to UBI, universal basic income, in the way that it's presented at a municipal level. But if you start looking at the federal level, it really doesn't make a lot of sense to me to be a policy that's being pushed. So taking that and also in context with the wealth tax, among other things, that, you know, we need to reconcile how much money we're actually going to be in debt after the CERB, that Sarah raises after a few other of the spending envelopes that we've seen, and something has to give. We can't continue to spend like this. So ultimately, a lot of our platform covers a lot of those. How we get back to balance. We're saying in 10 years we'll be able to get the budget back to balance. Ultimately, I believe we're the right party who's going to do that. We've done it in the past, and likely.
But Matt, what are you going to have to cut? What will the Conservatives have to cut to be able to balance budget? Or are you hoping, crossing your fingers, that the Canadian economy will rise sufficiently?
I think the latter is very a strong reality, particularly here in my province in Alberta and Western Canada. I think we're going to see, under a Conservative government, I think we're going to see a real confidence boost in say, the energy sector, the renewable sector out here. It's prime for that. So I think that's important. You know, we always get asked what we're going to cut. You know, ultimately, I don't want to cut things. It's, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, I'm raising my family in this country also. So going down the path of saying we're going to leave the country destitute because we want to cut a whole bunch of things, I think is factually inaccurate in a lot of ways. There's a ton of things on our platform that we're increasing EI benefits in a number of, you know, maternity, paternity leave. We're the housing crisis. I think we have the best plan for that. I think the support for families, you know, with the tax deductions. I think there's lots of things that don't necessarily point to cuts, but point to more of that necessary innovation and job creation that will just ripple across the country. And in my hope, rather quickly as we come out of COVID.
Right. That's a perfect time for me just to do a very quick reset. For people who are in the audience, we thank you for joining us. We know this has been somewhat of a momentous news day. So there are many other potential distractions on your time. So really thank you for being with us today at Mid-Atlantic. If you like the compare and contrast nature of what we do here, which is to look at UK politics, Canadian politics, and US politics, hit the little green icon, become a member of the Mid-Atlantic Club, and why don't you follow any of the excellent people on stage. Matt, I know that you have to go relatively soon, so I'm going to fire you another question before then moving on, and I want to look at Indigenous rights afterwards. But how has the pandemic affected canvassing? You're out there pressing the flesh, you know, with a good constituents out there in your riding. So how exactly has the pandemic affected that, especially in kind of high density buildings and apartment complexes? How have you managed to get out and meet your voters?
Yeah, great question, Orville. This is my fifth election, and certainly is a different one in a lot of ways. The big rallies that, you know, you try to pack the hall, make the photos look great. Those days are, well, they're gone for now, at least in terms of ensuring safe social distancing, you know, hand sanitizer all over the office, and masks in the office, a lot of those necessities in place. Well, we're out of the doors. It's, you know, I've always prided myself at any time I have a conversation, positive or negative, reach out and shake someone's hand and thank them for their time, for being able to chat with you. There's a lot less of that. I'm not doing that. There's a lot less people reaching out to shake, shake hands, often talking through the screen doors, and a lot less doors being opened too. I think ultimately that's, just the nervousness that, comes with here where we are in Alberta, rising COVID rates and the Delta variant. I think there's a lot of people just uneasy about this election. And then there's the actual voting piece. You know, a lot of our elementary schools, which are typically polling stations, have said not a chance this time around. Do we want to have a polling station through here? So the polling stations will be fewer, according to our local returning officer. And those polling stations will have shifted to larger centers than your local school that you're for the last 70 years you've been able to walk down the street and vote at. So it's a lot of things have changed this time around that are make it particularly challenging from a campaign perspective. But, you know, it's like the analogy in baseball, a rain delay affects everybody, not just one team over the other. So, you know, I think ultimately we're all in the same boat, but just trying to find our way through it.
Alex, there was a Disability Rights Act proposed during the last legislation, during the last parliament, very sorry. How would you like to see that bill maybe expanded upon? Is this the time, basically, for disabled and other able-bodied Canadians basically to pressure the Liberal Party and maybe the NDP to get some real concessions?
Okay. Are you talking about the Accessible Canada Act?
Absolutely.
Or the Canada Disability
Benefit? Well, let's deal with both, because this is a time when, and I think you said that, or maybe it was Sarah, that this bill was proposed just before going into the election. So maybe this is a time where maximum things can be extracted from the future government, whether it's Liberal or some kind of coalition or minority government.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of the Accessible Canada Act, based on what I've seen, a lot of it won't be implemented till 2040. So, you know, almost 20 years from now. It'll only apply to a fairly narrow scope of institutions. So I don't have a lot of faith in that bill being the answer for a lot of the issues that disabled folks have. And in terms of the Canada Disability Benefit, it's just, you know, they've just had the first reading, so it's just a very bare framework. We don't know what the regulations will look like because they haven't been developed yet. But I think the concern there is that they'll just give, you know, a certain amount of money to everybody. And if you've met one disabled person, you've met one disabled person. We're all unique. We all have different things we need. You know, some of us need a new $20,000 wheelchair every few years. So if you're just giving, you know, everyone a set amount of money, it's not gonna help people that you know have unique needs. So there's that concern with that bill. If you look, if you can contrast it with something like Leah Gazan's Motion 46, and full disclosure, I'm working on her campaign. But if you look at her motion, it doesn't replace any other benefits the person might be receiving. So if they receive a provincial benefit to get assistance to purchase a wheelchair, for example, Motion 46 would not replace that. They would receive any additional benefit on top of the benefits they already have. So I think the concern with the Canada's disability benefit is that, you know, they'll just receive a set amount of money and, you know, they'll still struggle with housing. It's impossible to find accessible housing in this country. They'll still have trouble affording their assistive devices, as Sarah mentioned. And, yeah, it'll still leave just a brutal patchwork of different supports that people are going to try to have to scramble to cobble together to meet their needs.
Let's move on to one of the other kind of key issues, which is wireless and broadband. And I think most Canadians will agree that the rates for broadband and wireless are somewhat absurd. It's some of the highest in the Western world. There was the Bill C-10. It was probably going to die since the election is being called. But the regulator, the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, is seen as being somewhat kind of toothless, powerless. There are many bits of Canada which practically have no broadband. Who would like to speak to this issue? Feel free to unmute yourself. Obviously, it's something which goes to the heart of accessibility, with maybe some rural communities not being able to fully be part of the digital community. And also it caps poorer Canadians in terms of their kind of access. And specifically when we've had a pandemic, which means that children have had to learn from home. So maybe, Alex, this is something which you could talk to in terms of its effect on business. If anybody else would like to chime in about the Liberals' promise to slash rates on broadband and the fact that wasn't actually delivered during the last parliament.
So I'd actually like to point over to something that I have no party affiliation anymore, but the NDP came up with something very interesting in their policy convention, where one of the things they wanted to talk about was a national regulated, run by the government telecommunications company. And I think that's actually an interesting approach to creating a lower rates is, you know, have the government come in. Hopefully they're going to be able to come in at a lower rate and then push all the other companies down in terms of lower rates. I think we're seeing a lot of struggling that rural communities have in terms of accessing the internet. Forget about the cost. There's just a lot of northern communities, a lot of rural communities that are just completely being left out. A lot of my clients, my First Nations clients, the normal thing is in the middle of a call, I lose connection if we're on a Zoom, or it's got to go to audio only. So there's a significant disadvantage to a lot of rural and Indigenous businesses as a result of that. And I'd like to see more solutions coming out of Ottawa than what we've already seen.
Last question. I'm going to go through everybody one by one. And then what we're going to do is we're going to round up the podcast, and then we're going to keep this room open. And then we'll accept questions, comments from the audience. So here we go. I'm going to start with you, Sarah. What's going to be the election of this? What's going to be the result, of this election come September 21st? What's your opinion?
I'm not really sure. I have no opinion on in terms of like how I think it will go. I haven't really looked at the polls, but I do hope that the NDP comes out strong, I think, for a lot of our futures in terms of policy and what we need to see implemented. I mean, I didn't really agree with the Conservative speaker who was framing things around cuts, right? He's the very same representative who is okay with privatizing long-term care after many people have died. And so I think what we heard today is that there are some parties, particularly the Conservative Party, that would prefer that we balance books and not, you know, put first people's lives, right? And the value of people's lives. And so I can't say what I would expect, but I do hope the NDP comes out strong.
The NDP coming out strong. Nadine, September 21st, what's going to be the outcome? Will we have another hung parliament with a minority government? Do you think that maybe the Liberals can form a majority? Will we have a strong showing from the NDP, or will low voter turnout, voter apathy, mean that support for that leftist party will erode? What do you reckon?
Well, when the election was called, I very much believed that Trudeau was going to get another majority. Because again, this is essentially the National Governing Party of Canada, and they believe that to be the case. So I don't think they would have called the election if they didn't have strong evidence that they would get a majority government. And I also think that the status quo is very good at maintaining itself. You know, when you look at, for example, discussion like, you know, the housing policy, who has the best housing policy? The question is for whom? Who is the housing policy? Who is any of the policies for? And there's a really strong status quo bent in a lot of the platforms. And so I think the folks who are going to come out and vote are people who are more likely to support, you know, the Liberals or wanting to have their taxes cut. And I think a lot of folks are going to stay home for this one. So I do think I would still probably favor a Liberal majority government as the outcome, unfortunately.
Amina, are we looking at a Liberal, a small Liberal majority government come September the 21st when the dust is settled on the election?
Yeah, I'm not sure, and I don't think so. I'm also leaning towards hoping for all of our sakes that what we do end up seeing is, you know, the NDPs coming out and having this one, to be honest. Sarah's made some great points, and many others have, as well as Nadine, in relation to the health crisis that we have, and a lot of the talk from, you know, the Conservatives and the PPC is about privatization. And I think that has shown us that is an absolute failure. I mean, we've seen with COVID-19, where reports have found significantly worse outcomes in essentially for-profit and non-profit, for-profit long-term care homes than in publicly run homes, where most of the outbreaks that we saw existed. And NDP leader Jagmeet Singh has essentially pledged, and I think is one of the only ones to pledge, to ban the opening of any new for-profit long-term care homes. And I know that some critics have argued that might not go enough, you know, go far enough, but it probably goes further than any of the other parties have proposed. And it does not speak to the 54% already existing privately owned long-term care homes that we would need to start discussing immediately and looking at bringing long-term care homes into the public hands under the same principles of the Canada Health Act. But yeah, I definitely am hoping to see more of a forward momentum, you know, from the NDP, and do not believe that the Liberals will be getting, you know, the majority that they seek.
Alex, let's run down the political parties. Who's going to have the largest party? Who's going to be the second? And what approximately will the seat tally be for the Liberals, the Conservatives, the NDP, the Bloc, and the Green Party?
Right. So currently we have 155 Liberals, 119 Conservatives, 32 Bloc, 24 NDP, 2 Green, and a few Independent. Almost certainly we're going to see a growing of new Democratic seats. We're going to see a decrease in Bloc Quebecois seats. We're going to see a status quo of Green seats, and we're going to see a slight increase of Conservative. And this is going to come at the expense probably of the Liberals. I think the math is almost inconceivable that the Liberals will end up with a majority this time around.
Thank you for that. Right. And if anybody else would just like to have one final last word, one takeaway, maybe one thing we should look at, one thing we should notice in this election, feel free to unmute yourself, and then we'll wrap up the recording of the podcast. What is the key thing which you think will be significant in maybe determining the result of this election?
I would love to hear from Nadine Nakagawa, City Councillor Nadine, in relation to childcare, which seems to be a, you know, major campaign issue that all of the parties are sort of touting. The conservative platform is only essentially offering a child care tax credit, which we know will ultimately favor wealthier participants, whereas, you know, the liberals have used child care, you know, essentially as a campaign strategy and haven't done very much, you know, during their actual government, proposing to spend $30 billion over 5 years in an effort to bring, you know, the federal government to a 50-50 cost sharing for childcare with the provinces and territories, whereas the NDP have also proposed a universal $10 a day childcare system across the country. What we do see is an actual shortage of infrastructure investment in actual childcare spaces. And since Nadine has done extensive work in this area, you know, I'd really love to hear about childcare as a primary issue in relation to childcare spaces on this campaign.
Thanks, Amina. I think you actually summed it up really beautifully there. And I think to phrase this issue in an overall lens, it's whether or not we believe that the government should be providing social services, similar to what you said about long-term care. Should that be provided by government itself? Or should we sort of give out tax breaks to people who can then write it off against taxes? Because again, who are we centering in that decision-making? And I think that's very true of childcare as well, is like, do we believe in giving people money off of their taxes or sort of small bits of money? Or do we believe in this in being part of our social safety net? And I think the overall lesson that I am wanting to sort of see in this campaign is, what have we learned during this pandemic about collective action and about taking care of vulnerable members of our community? Because it's quite terrifying that we have collectively gone through this experience, recognizing that, you know, seeing that, you know, I was very scared for my grandmother living in a care center. I didn't think I'd ever see her again. This is a woman who's 98 years old and lived through Japanese internment. And she said the experience was similar to being interned. What have we learned from this experience overall? Have we learned that we should just sort of buy our way out of it, and people should be able to, you know, pay for, you know, to be able to isolate or pay for air conditioners during the heat waves that we've been experiencing due to climate crisis? Or do we actually believe that we need to pull together and have the government as a key part of that? I think that's the biggest reflection that I look forward to sort of seeing how that narrative unfolds in this election.
Thank you for nailing one of the most important key election issues that Canada is facing, how it looks after the most vulnerable, its children. So thank you, Alex Bishop, Nadine Nakagawa, Amina Yasmin, Sarah Jama, and we had Alan Mankiewicz, and we also had Matt Genero, MP, who joined us. Hopefully, what we've been able to do is give you a little bit of an insight, whether you're Canadian or not, because 3/4 of the listeners of this podcast are not actually Canadian. Just giving you a little bit of an insight into some of the key issues that Canadians are facing as they go to the polls next month in September. And maybe some of those issues are resonant with you in your country, whether you're in the UK or in the US. So don't forget, folks, if you want to basically join one of these shows, quite simply join on to Clubhouse, the Clubhouse app, and then you can be part of the audience. After we stop recording, basically we do keep the rooms open and debate and conversation does flow from there. So if you would like to be part of the conversation, please join Clubhouse, find Mid-Atlantic, hit the little green icon, become a member, and you'll be alerted when these shows are actually recorded. Generally, they're on a Thursday, not always, but generally. So please, we'd love to see you. Go to a podcatcher of your choice. We've been doing this show for 7 years, all about kind of cross-Atlantic kind of politics. So if you go to midatlanticshow.com, there is a vast treasure trove of back issues there. You'll also find a way of contacting me if you'd like to refute maybe something which somebody said, or maybe even suggest a future topic for us to look at. So that's midatlanticshow.com. Hit the contact us and you can find me on there. Thank you to everybody on stage. Thank you to those in the audience, because there's a lot of pulls on people's time today of all days with what's actually happened in Afghanistan and that whole unfolding crisis and tragedy. So we thank you for stopping by and listening to informed, passionate Canadians talk about issues which are going to inform the Canadian election. Don't forget, folks, left of centre politics is right thinking politics. This has been me, Royful Brown, and Mid-Atlantic.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.